This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you worried about the gas prices? And everybody knows that oil is going to run out sooner or later. It's a phenomenon we might call peak oil. Then we'll toss in climate change and the financial mess. Who knows when that's going to crash? This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I'm here in downtown Vancouver with our special guest, Kathy McMahon. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's got some good ideas about how to deal with all that stress. So, Kathy, I'm going to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How did you get started in this? Tell us a little bit about your background and what drew you to these sorts of problems.
Well, I found out about peak oil, and I was going through my own emotional reactions to it, freaking out myself. And so I was trying to figure out what I could do to begin to tackle it, you know, be able to figure out how to resolve it and work in the way that I can. And so I started Peak Oil Blues basically because I was interested in having other people tell me their stories about what happened to them when they discovered peak oil. What were their emotional reactions? I wanted to see if they were similar to mine, different than mine. And then what did they do to change their lives as a result of finding out about it? So that's how it got started. It was really personal for me to learn about it and be kind of spooked about it and upset about it, and then just trying to figure out what was normal, what was a normal reaction from what was just, you know, acting mental, you know. So.
Yes, I understand. Well, I see in your blog, peakoil.com, that ordinary people, people just off the street, it seems, have written some pretty letters with a lot of feeling about their reactions. Can you tell us about a couple of those letters? What are people saying?
Well, they're just talking about the process they go through. The first process that they report is that they're shocked. And the experience, the physiological experience of shock, is that their mind keeps functioning, so they keep reading, they keep researching, but their emotions start to shut down. And with that emotional shutdown, it's sort of like they're walking around in a fog. And they're reading and they're studying and they're trying to make sense of it, but they're really starting to feel very disconnected from the world around them. So the second emotional reaction that often happens is that people, as I said, begin this intensive research because particularly for engineers, for people who have a scientific background, they can't believe that there's not an answer out there. So they keep researching and attempting to find the solution to the problem, and it keeps them up at night. They go through all kinds of anxiety reactions. They try and talk with other people about it, and they start having, they feel increasingly alienated from other people. Basically they are having a meltdown around learning about something that what I've come to learn is really not a problem. It's a dilemma. And the difference between a problem and a dilemma is that a problem has a solution. A dilemma is between a rock and a hard place. A dilemma, no matter which way you go, you're still having a situation where you're going to have difficulties. You're going to have major problems that are going to result from the options or the attempts to fix the problem. So that's hard, I think, for most people. And the social isolation that they feel as a result of learning about this stuff is equally difficult for them because they realize that they can't do it alone. And what they mostly want is to be able to connect with other people, talk with them about the problem, and work collectively to try and mitigate it the best they can. But they face a lot of denial when they try and talk with other people about it.
Right. We find out that the whole world is really based on oil. The things that we eat are fertilized with it. The things that we buy are made out of it, and our cars and our buildings and all of that. It depends on oil. So it's quite a shock. And then they go to a family gathering or such, and who wants to hear about it, you know? It seems sometimes that other people are sleepwalking their way through this problem. Now, you've coined some terms as a clinical psychologist, for people's reactions or how they try not to handle it, let's say. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. Well, I talk about Panglossian disorders, which is being unrealistically, almost psychotically happy and optimistic in the face of likely planetary and cultural collapse. And I do that sort of as a reaction to the label that a lot of people put on people that are taking these three issues, climate change, environmental degradation, and economic collapse. They put labels on them like Debbie Downer or buzzkill. Or, you know, we have a lot of words to describe somebody who's pessimistic. But I felt like we didn't have any words to describe somebody that was overly optimistic. So a Panglossian disorder has a variety of manifestations, but it's basically a way in which somebody is using defensive structures in order to not take in the information, in order to bat it back, to minimize it, to attempt the best that they can not to accept the information that's coming at them.
So what is Rhett Butlerism?
It's, you know, frankly, Charlotte, I don't give a damn. You can tell me all about peak oil. You could tell me about climate change. I don't care. It's just not going to be an important issue for me. You're just wasting my time talking about it. And in fact, I might get angry at you for bringing it up because I got enough troubles. I'm dealing with enough stuff on my own, and I don't need any more bad news.
Well, I can see that in a way because we have a situation. I was talking with a young girl today in a mall, and I asked her about peak oil. She'd sort of vaguely heard about it, climate change. She'd definitely heard about the financial system. She was worried about it. But she said, you know, and she was about 23, she said, I'll be dead before all that really happens.
Yeah.
You know. I won't live that long anyway, and I'm thinking, wow, you have at least 60 years ahead of you, you know, possibly, and you're the generation that we're counting on to do something. So what are you finding with young people, college students? Have you heard from them? What are they feeling?
I think they feel despair, to be honest with you, the ones that my contributors that are that age. They're put in a really difficult position, especially in the States. A lot of them have graduated school with enormous debt, college debt, and they realize that they can never escape that debt, and that they can't find jobs that will help them to service that debt. And I think that, you know, while you have young people like the woman that you were talking about saying basically, I'll be dead by the time that that happens, and again, I see that as a sort of a temporal denial. I think there's a lot of young people that really do get it and are absolutely overwhelmed, because they begin to see their choices as really untenable. One young woman said, I have to choose between having children and being safe. So that was, I never made that connection that somehow having children in a family would make me inherently unsafe. And for her, she saw the need for finding a place to live that was going to be safe for her, that would make, you know, that she would make decisions that were going to be beneficial to her, but somehow would be detrimental to the options that she has for having a family, for example. And even the decision to have children for a lot of these young people is a really moral decision, because they feel like they're bringing children into an overpopulated world, an overshoot world, where the child, at best, is going to have a very difficult life if they're able to survive at all. So I do think that there are a lot of young people who are overwhelmed by the everyday challenges that they have and really do not want to think about it, really want to bat it back and minimize it. But I think that there's a lot of young people that are fully aware of what's going on. Some of them are really active in permaculture. Some of them are really just despairing, and they write to me saying that.
Yes, well, I find that I just interviewed two psychologists, environmental psychologists. One was Robert Gifford from Canada, and the other was Joseph Reeser from Australia. And they worked on the American Psychological Association report that just came out about anxiety on climate change. Mm-hmm. But there was no hint, as far as I could tell in the report, that we would develop a new therapy to help individuals deal with this. Now, is that more the direction that you're heading?
No, I guess I'm working mostly with activists. I'm working with people that get it, and the lectures that I'm doing mostly are filled with people who really do understand what's going on, and they want to be told, yeah, there's a reason to be concerned. And no, you're not crazy because you're worried that you have problems in sleeping, that you really are having to manage your anxiety or compartmentalize so that you can just deal with it in your everyday life and not really go into a panicky kind of mode. That's how I see myself, is really to normalize some of the emotions that they're having. I don't see it as therapy, and I don't like the idea that a lot of people have written in the past about pathologizing reactions like post-petroleum stress disorder. I think that's a very destructive frame around coming to grips with this stuff. I understand the desire for it to be able to say what you're going through is real, but there's another part of me that thinks that we have enough pathologizing of people who are taking the world's problems seriously, so we don't really need to add on to them. So I don't see it as therapy. I see it as, giving my two cents, being able to sort of, from my personal opinion, telling them, I'm reading what you're saying, I'm understanding what you're saying, but have you considered this? Have you really taken yourself seriously? Because if you take yourself seriously, then the behaviors that you're engaging in don't seem to assist you or don't seem to help you. And so a lot of my work on my blog is really working towards helping people hear what they're saying, even though they're writing me saying it, and then taking themselves seriously enough to start to do the kinds of actions that are going to impact the fears that they have about the future. I'll give you an example. There was one guy who wrote me who lived in New York City. And he said that for the last 30 years, he was well aware of climate change and peak oil and economic collapse. And I won't go into the whole story, but one of my responses was, well, you're a gambler. Because even though you're aware of it, you chose to live in New York City, probably the, one of the major metropolitan areas in the world. Which really does not have a lot of resources unless they have oil on it. He chose to marry and have a child, and now what he's freaked out about is that while he feels he can keep himself safe, he doesn't think he can keep his daughter or his wife safe. So that's the work that I do, is I'm trying to help people to really hear themselves and really begin to process what they're telling me about their worldview, and to say, well, maybe you need to begin to actually take yourself seriously if you believe that that we're going to have an economic crash. Why do you have your retirement funds in a 401k? But we live in a world where there is a split in consciousness, where on the one hand we have all of these beliefs. But a lot of my readers talk about it like the Matrix. We have these beliefs in our computers when we read, when we listen to your show. And then we go out into the world, and like the Matrix, the movie The Matrix, it all seems to be fine. Nothing seems to be wrong. We talk to our friends. They're all going on vacation next year, and they're all sort of seeming to be completely oblivious. So for a lot of my contributors, they're wondering, what's real? Is it real for me to, be aware of peak oil and the problems that are coming? Or is this Matrix-like world the real world? And so, like I said, that's where I think you're really having the split in consciousness between what should I do based on what I believe is happening and what should I do based on what everyone else is doing.
Well, Kathy McMahon, as a clinical psychologist, I know on your blog, peakoilblues.com, that there's still room for humor. You still say, well, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of it. So how do you get that humor going in the face of such serious problems? What's the role there for?
Yeah, I mean, what I say is if I can't dance, I don't want the Armageddon. I think that you have to have a sense of humor. Humor is a coping mechanism. Humor is the way in which we learn the absurdity of the situation that we're facing. The craziness, the bizarre mental attitudes that basically say we can survive perfectly well with a planet that has 10 or 12 or 15 billion people on it. And you have intelligent people saying these insane things, and everyone's nodding their head like, oh, yes, that makes perfect sense. You know, it's insane. And so I think if you don't have a sense of humor about it, which is an adaptive defense mechanism, if you don't have people that you can laugh with, if you don't make light of it because the situation is hopeless but not serious, that dual way of looking at the world, I think that you can get really depressed. You can feel really miserable about it, and I think it's too hard to always be too serious. I think it's really hard for your friends and your family to be around somebody who's always very, very, very grim. So I think humor is a way of just saying, yeah, you know, you're going to buy a new car, oh, good luck. You could probably get a big one because you probably need to sleep in it eventually. Or, you know, oh, that dog is really cute, but it looks a little small to eat, and in terms of defense, it won't be helpful to you. You know, you got to have that sense of humor. And I think particularly among my community that I affectionately call Doomers, we have that sense of humor. We have the ability to laugh at ourselves, to make fun of a situation which is dire, is extremely serious, and all of us, because we're human, have real difficulty in looking into it and facing it and accepting just how real it is.
And there's a growing number of people who feel better if they can take some sort of action. So they're thinking about raising chickens or going into the transition movement or in some way being more sufficient. So at least if there's an economic crash, they might have something to eat. Is that part of the direction that you're looking at as well?
I think that one of the most important things that people can do is to decide where they want to live and then create a community around that. One of the things that I say is it's important to take a map of where you live, you know, put a pin in your house and then draw a 5 and 10 mile radius around it, and basically to develop a really old-fashioned concept called neighbors, that the people who live around you are your neighbors, and you're going to have really strange bedfellows as a result of that. And you have to accept that people are annoying. So your neighbors are, not you, of course, or me, but people in general are annoying. And so what you have to do is you have to develop a sense of humor about it. You have to understand you're not the center of the universe. And the oil really gives us that opinion. We get to have, you know, designer friends. We get to have a designer life, designer religion. We can go, you know, an hour from our home in order to worship with people who share all of our similarities, all of our values. And so what I'm saying is we really have to look seriously at where we live, that patch of ground, and start to invest in that patch of ground and start to accept that the people that live next to us, whether we like them or not, they are our survival mechanism, or they will be our enemy. And so if we still have the resources, while we still have the resources, it's time to get to know them. It's time to begin to take ourselves a little less seriously, even our value systems and our cherished belief systems a little less seriously, and to reach out to them and to accept what I like to say is we're all a bunch of bozos. You know, we really are. We're just more human than otherwise. And so those people living next to you are more human than otherwise too. They're your backup. They're the people who are going to be there when you don't have the gas to get wherever you need to go. They're the people who you'll need to rely on to be able to help you get through the kinds of things that are coming. And we don't know exactly what's coming, but none of it looks good.
You know, I think that's a beautiful place to wrap it up, your expression of community and finding other people. I think that's kind of the basis that I would follow as well. So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm here with Kathy McMahon, the clinical psychologist. She has a blog called peakoilblues.com, which I've been surfing. I think there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I encourage anyone to go out and have a listen to it. And I also want to thank John Cooksey, who's been here. John has a fine new film out called How to Boil a Frog. I can't recommend it highly enough. get out and look at that. It is hysterical. So with that, we're going to wrap up this edition of Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for tuning in.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.